Hey, everybody.
Everyone.
How are we?
Welcome to...
We've already done this. We did the intro.
Oh, that's right.
We'll edit out this part right now.
Don't have to edit it out.
No, we
I
don't.
Gave up caffeine.
Okay.
And so even though it's midday, I'm struggling a little bit. So
really?
I used to have two sugar-free Red Bulls a day. I was maybe up to three at one point. And so going from that many to nothing, sorry if I'm loopy, folks.
Yes.
Please understand that this is so maybe you'll just okay. Anyway, back. I see loopy. Back on point. Okay.
Yes.
So
let's introduce our guest. Romy, take it away.
Welcoming the lovely Nikki Andress here. Hi, Nikki.
Nikki.
Hello.
Pleasure to have you on board. Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And so I want to clarify because I think this is still so new for people, and I think that part of this is to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And so what would I call you? Is it transgender? Or,
yes.
Okay.
So, and this has been an evolution for even like within the queer community. Because just like the word queer has very much been reclaimed, at least for my generation, there is still older generations for whom it's nothing but derogatory and it's a problematic word for them. Similarly, for the trans community, especially because, and I think gender dysphoria is still in the DSM-5. But at one point in time, just like homosexuality, we were considered a psychological disorder. And so there's language around that is problematic. And also, the language used in pornography. And for the record, I'm very sex positive. I'm down for pornography, but I want it to be positive pornography.
Yeah.
That's promoting.
So what's an example of in pornography that's derogatory and detrimental at the moment?
Oh, very good. And just for the record, trigger warning for any trans listeners, it's education moment. because, it's used as hate speech against us. So it can be really hard for some people to hear. But like terms like she-male or tranny, now call that the T slur.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, like I reclaim that word for myself in kind of a fun, radical way. But being more and more part of the community publicly, I also just think it's important to remain sensitive to, the evolution. And, it's all right. I'm not tied to it.
Yeah. Cause you're not everybody. Like you're not a representative of everybody. Like there's
exactly.
So many individuals. Well, I mean, everybody is an individual and all that sort of stuff. So is trans acceptable?
Yes. Actually, that's the gold star one.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause it's like the shortening that's more inclusive. Cause I actually identify as trans feminine and gender queer. I'm non-binary. I look very cis binary. Cisgender is, when your gender assigned at birth, based usually on your body appearance, matches the gender that you're assigned.
So like Romy and myself.
Yes. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So you found out, now I knew you when you were Nick.
Yeah.
But you were already out. You were very proud of being a gay man. And I've always admired you for that because you just went there. It was still a point where it was still, a lot of people were still in the closet. And this was only about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Was it 10 years ago?
Yeah. Gosh, yeah. It has been.
Yeah. So even
we're Asian. Uh-oh. We're 20 forever.
Yeah, thank you.
It's so true though. It's so true.
She hasn't aged a day, and that is the truth.
Fuck
she
you.
We go backwards.
We go backwards. We're Benjamin Button.
Right.
Yeah. Basically. No, but so I knew you when you were Nick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had this conversation with you, but I think you always knew from a very young age that you were gay.
Oh, yeah. And like queer with a capital Q. And that's part of at least my personal journey is the vocabulary surrounding our, queer LGBTQIA experiences. And, from my Midwestern background, that's very kind of binary and just sheltered from a lot of queer issues.
Mm-hmm.
There was pretty much straight or gay, and anything gay meant that you were somehow gender deviant from whatever the cis normative standard was for your assigned gender. So in a more accessible way to say that, if you were raised a boy and expected to be a boy, gay for you just meant feminine. Similarly, if you were, you know, assigned a girl and raised as a girl and expected to be a girl, anything that was potentially masculine was considered gay, you know, lesbian,
like tomboy, butch, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Can I use that word? Can I say
butch and femme are, I mean, they, femme comes from French, but those terms are usually not derogatory. A lot of people use them to claim their own sort of flavor of gender inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I have a femme gender presentation. I very much enjoy classically feminine fashion and silhouettes and like hair and nails and everything.
And you always have been.
Always. Yeah. Ever since I was a kid. But then like the butch side of me is very, you know, like, I'm overconfident. I'm not combative, but, it's hard to talk about without using gender stereotypes language, you know, like, oh, I'm masculine in this way, my feminine side. Mm. It's like, really, I, the way I kind of challenge myself and other people to think about it is, so let's look at the good things, the virtues. Let's focus on the positive, right? What are things that you hear or that are virtues for being, say, masculine? What, strong, brave, intelligent?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are the things for femininity? Well, I want you to be strong. I want you to be brave.
I
want you to be intelligent.
Yeah. No, I get
they're
you.
All
yeah.
the same.
Yeah.
And we might, you know, we might assign different colors and shapes to them, but that's all bullshit, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, I say celebrate all the beautiful things. And thankfully, we're in a period right now where there's a lot of shifting and awakening, and people are being more welcoming and curious about inclusion, not just for themselves, but, you know, for people that they know and love.
Yeah.
And so I'm very optimistic about
yeah,
the future.
Yeah, I, you know, it's something that, you know, if especially if you look back, say, 10, 20 years ago, it's a slow process, but it's a process, and things do change and will change and are changing.
Yeah. And
over time. It's just, as you said, education. And, you know, like, I mean, using, you know, as you said, like masculine and feminine could be a good way to kind of go, okay, this is what you would probably see it as, and then explain it from there so people can kind of keep up and things like that. Does that make sense?
I think, you know, the language can be complicated. So
does it get complicated in your, like in the community? Like,
And lately, at least, you know, in my queer community in LA, it's not that, I mean, it's pretty celebrated and people are aware and open and learning. But like, for instance, well, like to go to your original point, Romy, I always knew since I was probably three, I'm like, I'm a girl boy. And because I didn't know, there was no way to say, I'm non-binary, trans, feminine, gender queer, right? Like, we didn't have that.
Yeah.
So it's like,
I just felt something.
Yeah, I just felt something. I'm just like, it's like, I don't hate my body, but I know I'm not a boy and I never want to be a man.
Mm.
You know? So it was like, for me, as much as a cognitive, even though like the instinct was there, the cognitive processing about what that meant and how to explain it to other people, how to even explain it to myself, came with language. So that's why I always say, it's like, look, labels are useful as much as they're helping you discover things, right?
Explain things, make
sense of things. But we can't get married to them because they're limited in their scope. I champion coming up with new words and labels can be important if they reinforce your identity, but I really think they should be, you know, like true adjectives, you know, they modify something that's already there rather than, you know, being the genesis of something. Cause I just personally don't think it's very healthy to live a life by a script. You know, we all have to kind of discover what's right for us. And we can try different stories. We can try different tropes. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But I just think ultimately each individual owes it to themselves to think for themselves, to feel for themselves, and to love themselves on their own terms.
Now, you are also an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say, because I remember when you were an actor and you had to go in, and when you were auditioning for certain parts, you had to play straight. Mm-hmm. And then now, and then you embraced yourself. And now, how was that transition of now going up for one certain type of part and then transitioning into another? Because I will say, once you did embrace yourself fully, and I followed you on Instagram, even though you and I hadn't talked for a bit, I was still, you started working a lot.
I'm glad that's your perception, because I didn't work for 5 years
after
coming out.
Oof.
Yeah. But it was, I'm so glad that's your perception though, because at least part of my professional journey, being of the generation I am, and for you listeners, because you can't see my youthful face.
I'm of, she ain't lying.
Right? We call the Oregon Trail generation, right? So we like, we had analog childhood, digital adulthood. We grew up at the same rate as technology through the 90s and 2000s.
Oh wait, what are we called again? I've never heard this.
Because I think I'm in this generation as well. Yeah,
we both are.
Yeah.
But we're the Oregon Trail generation, or the Zennials.
I think I've heard Zennials. Yeah.
So like that. We've gone through technology together, which is so true.
The rise of technology accelerated more or less at the same rate as our
development.
Yeah. So like our adolescence was like CDs, and then our early adulthood was digital, and then like our full adulthood is HD and streaming. So, I mean,
what's next, huh?
Yeah, it's just it's so cool.
So is it going to die the same time we do?
just evolve to the next plane of existence.
Well, I can see things just being immediately just beamed into our heads. I think like in 2030, who knows? But you know, like you answer a phone call and you just press a button like on the side of your head, and you're talking with them like right there and then. That's how I see.
I would not want to be a part of that. Imagine.
Well, we probably won't be around for that.
Okay, thank God. No, but imagine having everybody hear your thoughts. It's like, what's that movie with Ricky Gervais where everybody has to tell the truth?
I know the one you're talking about though.
Is that the one with the dead people?
No, that's Ghost Town. Ghost.
Yeah, I know the one you're talking. Mm-hmm. It's not Lie to Me. That's a TV series.
The Invention of Lying?
Yeah.
Was it called The Invention of Lying?
Yes, that's it. Okay. Yeah, Invention of Lying.
But it's like that. It's like you, there's no filter.
Yeah.
Mm. How awful would that be?
Gosh.
Well, I mean, who knows? By the time that technology comes around, like everybody is starting to become so open and sharing on social media and on the internet that maybe by the time
they share their good things, people, and this is what we see, their highlights reel. We do not see what's going on behind
the
scenes.
That's true. But maybe by the time this technology comes around, that like we've gone through this evolution where people have no problems sharing their dirty laundry. And it's just, it is what it is.
It could be one of those like ping pongy evolutionary things, right? Yeah. Where it's like, oh, so we start getting some kind of, you know, maybe artificial telepathy, but then we also kind of have to develop, you know, a self-defense sort of system for that. So like, I'm sure people come up with like filters and blockers and all this other stuff.
Like software that goes into our heads and things like that.
I see, again.
We're writing a sci-fi film right now.
Exactly.
But I love this concept though, right? Because like if you think, it reminds me of...
It's scary to me. It's frightening.
Yeah.
For sure.
But as I said, like when it comes out, it's probably just, you know, regular and just everyday occurrence. Like kids these days, they're growing up in the digital world. And so it's what we went through.
I think even with that, you know, that's the perspective, right? When you're the kid, when you're riding the wave and you don't know any better, it's all just what the world is. And you get to take for granted all the possibilities. The people responsible for your safety are the ones paranoid about parental controls and the exposure and the exploitation and all of that stuff. It's whatever it is, it's bound to make a lot of people money. And that, in my experience, it's a very cynical opinion, but if anything, that's what's going to motivate whatever the next zeitgeist is.
Capitalism is a major motivator in this country.
Well, I mean, that's what happens. Like even in like horrible events, there's going to be somebody who's going to make money from that.
War.
Perfect example. The people make a shit ton of money through war.
I've had people say to me, you know, cancer is a moneymaker.
Absolutely it is.
And it's just, it's a horrible thing to think about.
Mm. Yeah, totally.
Especially when you've had people you've lost to cancer and you think,
No, like, you know, of course that means, you know, there are people who want to do good and are working within the system that's been created for them to fight cancer and to beat cancer. But, you know, it's a moneymaker. And so, yeah. On that happy note. Yeah, on that happy note.
So how did we...
How did we veer off that way?
I did want to respond to...
I thought you were doing very well, but you had a 5-year period where you were...
Yes, where I was not working, not auditioning, nothing. And you know, my agent at the time had warned me, he's like, look, I support you personally. This is great. I want you to be you. I want you to be happy. As a pretty gay Twinkie male, the volume of auditions...
By the way, Twinkie, in case... Dan, do you know what a Twinkie is?
A twink.
A twink. No.
It means you're yellow on the outside, white on the inside.
Oh, so like a Twinkie.
Oh, a Twinkie. Oh, okay. So I was a double. I was a twink Twinkie when I was a gay boy. Wait,
did you mean something else?
What's a twinkie?
So a Twinkie is, yellow. It's a derogatory thing. But when you say it for yourself, it's funny. So,
exactly.
It's one of those things that's like, we can say it because that's what we are.
Yeah.
It's yellow on the outside, white on the inside, like a banana.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Yeah, the other one. Yeah. Banana.
And then twink in the gay community refers to like a young, hopefully over 18, but like a young looking, usually thin or very lean kind of young man who's a little bit waifish, a little bit
So you're
fit.
A twink.
I was a twink when I was a gay boy, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's like that was already a very niche type.
Mm-hmm.
And because like as an actor, as an artist, like we all train and we believe we can play whatever, you know, we are called to play, but because it's an industry and there are tropes and stereotypes and, you know, established sort of expectations for things, sometimes it can be very challenging to get ahead of that. So I understand the nature of the business. I was not naive about that. But he said, so coming out as trans, that's the volume might shrink even more. And he's like, but I'm with you 100%.
Good for him.
You know, and he was great. Then he retired and went, it's cool. I've got a team right now. They're fantastic. And then there was, just maybe 3 years ago or something, kind of, renaissance. And it's just sort of the expansion and contraction of extremism and moderatism, I think, in our culture, politically, everything, you know, I'm not getting too deep into that. Just the timing of everything makes sense from, you know, a cultural sort of cause and effect point of view. And I got to, you know, tip my hat off to, you know, the Casting Society of America and Breakdown Services and the LGBT Center. I was part of a workshop that, the Casting Society wanted to make sure that they were representing and including trans identities and non-binary identities in respectful, inclusive ways. Because up until that point, it was just drag queen. And like drag is a very specific kind of performance art whose subject is gender. You celebrate it, you lampoon it. It's part of everything. And that's what makes it so brilliant and kind of crossing boundaries and opening people's hearts and minds. Because it's just that kind of weird, you know, alternate dimension sort of peek into.
And is drag queen is generally a man playing a character. Is that what it is?
I would say the most famous and popular queens are
RuPaul.
Gay men whose personas are femme. But drag, because it's an art form that celebrates and lampoons gender, anybody, whether you're cis or trans, can participate in drag as an art form.
Okay, I got you. I understand. Yeah.
So, and that's also, it's a point of discussion in the LGBT community as well. Rue himself, who has, said some things and changed their mind. I mean, the thing is, I don't shade anybody for making a mistake if they own it. And if they want to grow from it, or even, hey, if they say, I stand by it. Like, I think it also takes guts to just speak your mind. And even when people don't like it, that you, I mean, freedom of speech, man, you know?
Yeah. What did RuPaul say that the community had a problem with?
Ru had said that they would not have trans contestants on Drag Race.
Okay.
But that has changed. And they changed their point of view. And it was just, it was, and there had already been trans contestants on Drag Race. And it just seemed really disingenuous that at the time, that Ru was taking such an essentialist point of view about what drag is or should or could be.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a lot of people who came up through, you know, ball culture and kind of the origin of all of this, queer culture as we know it, you know, really also took issue in that, you know, Ru's path was a little different. And so their perspective of that was just more from the outside than from the inside. And so that was controversial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think it's good that there is these wonderfully diverse and strong opinions within the LGBT community, because our history is so old and so new at the same time. And it's difficult to access unless you really seek out being part of a community. A lot of it's still oral history. And at this point, you know, internet oral history. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, and there are, of course, you know, books and academic sort of things on it. But compared to, you know, mainstream Western cishet normative, you know, history class, you know, it's just something that's really taken for granted. So I think it's really important. And many of us who have identified as queer and been in communities for a long time are still learning about our history and our people. And, you know, and as, you know, the LGBTQIA, you know, well, as the acronym expands into alphabet soup. It's a joke we always make. Because it's one of those kind of ironic things where it's like in the effort to be even more inclusive, it's like, okay, well, now we're just splitting hairs.
is that a problem?
I wouldn't say it's a problem, but for some people resent it. Yeah. A lot of people, you know, lovingly joke about it because it's that thing. And you get this as an actor of color as well. It's like, representation is so important. Seeing people like you in the media, or even somewhat like you in the media, that, you know, there's just diversity in general is super important. And that calling out these individual identities and experiences is invaluable. On the other hand, it's also a matter of efficiency, where it's like, oh, diversity is just everybody's different and unique. Well, great. But what does that look like? It's like a Jackson Pollock painting where everybody is a different drop of paint. Like that, it may not, it still needs a context in order to make sense to people. So I think it's a beautiful kind of animal that's always evolving and changing, a chameleon. But at its heart, at least in any kind of advocacy that I do, it's about education and appreciation.
Mm. How do you feel, what are the main differences from having been a boy to now being a girl, and the different pressures of you now being a woman? Like, for instance, the need to put moisturizer on, do your hair nicely, have your nails done, and as opposed
to... Well, those are all clues that I was trans when I was a boy.
I was going to say, I was like, I bet she was doing that.
It's one of those evolutions. It's like, I have this joke in my stand-up set where I'm just like, looking back, it was obvious. Like, we didn't have language for it. It was obvious, right? But it is, and this is something that I talk about too in terms of transition, because a lot of binary trans identified folks do medically transition with hormone replacement therapy and or top surgery and or bottom surgery, gender confirmation surgery, as we call it. Just educational moment. We believe it's most appreciative and respectful to call it gender confirmation surgery, not reassignment surgery, because it celebrates, you know, your agency and your, you know, authentic self rather than treating you like there was a mistake made along the way. The mistake is not the individual. It's just the problem of society being too narrow in terms of what the mainstream idea of human experience is. But to get to your question, in my experience, yeah, internally, everything has kind of been the same my whole life. And I'm very fortunate to have grown up with a sister. So I had access to Barbies and hair products and nail polish and just all like the little superficial femme things that, you know, capitalism tells us that we should need. But definitely I noticed socially when, especially because I guess I'm fortunate in that even though I'm not medically transitioning, I appear physically very kind of classically and commercially femme. Which that kind of whole thing about cis passing is a big topic in our community, mostly because of safety. Because when you're visibly trans, you're at risk for violence, which too often results in, you know, murder. So aside from just a safety issue, it can also just be, and I don't want to say it's a vanity thing, but you know, it's just one of those like echo chamber sort of things, right? You exist in a culture in which there are certain values placed on binary cisgender normativity. And so there's pressure to conform in order to feel safe, in order to belong, in order to have any opportunity to be seen for who you really are. But it's not like there are a lot of cis people who are not, you know, just magically commercially cis passing, quote unquote, in a way. And, you know, the beauty magazines, and not to blame beauty magazines. I'm using that as a stand-in villain. But, you know, like our culture, motivates people to feel shame for not being what is most marketed as what the thing is should be. Yes. I digress again. But actually, that's a good segue because I would say one of the first things I noticed was I had escaped a lot of the microaggressions as well as the straight-on misogyny that my cisgender sisters grew up with your entire lives, right? Mm-hmm. I knew about it as a feminist and I was aware of it as a gay boy who is feminine, but I still had that kind of male privilege that allowed me to not have to deal with it if I didn't want to all the time. And after coming out as trans and living socially as a woman, oh my goodness, there was just such a steep learning curve. Mm. And I'm still, you know, as an intersectional feminist, you know, I'm still learning stuff, right? I mean, and you know, lots of cis women are too. I'm not saying that, oh, just because I, you know, was born with a penis, I can never learn or I'll never be good. Good at feminism. Can you be good at that? But I think you know what I mean.
I do.
Yeah. So it's like little things, from sexual harassment to interruption to like people thinking that they can walk, like they're surprised by my assertiveness and put off by it even. And it's like, whoa, here I am being like super sweet and connecting with you and really being respectful of your opinions and your times. And I'm still the bitch. Like how and why? Oh, because I'm a woman now. You know, it's like, it's true. It's like for any doubters out there who say that, you know, misogyny and patriarchy are not as serious and not as pervasive as, you know, oh, we feminists are always talking about, like, you're not listening to the women in your lives. You know?
You're here.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I can't agree with you more. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Oh, yeah. No, it's collaboration.
No,
yeah.
I love listening. I'm just...
So it's a lot of stuff like that. And, but I also feel like, because I'm challenged, sometimes I feel... shame, not a gender dysphoric shame in that being, and I talk about my dick all the time, so like, this is cool. A lot
Me
of
true.
A lot of true. So we're compatible then.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like a lot of trans
me
people.
Me too.
Perfect. Me too. Yeah. Hashtag me too on the podcast. Yeah.
We're talking about penises.
Yep. Just swigging.
In a consensual fashion. That's a trigger warning. Penis talk. But yeah, I mean, it's of course, it's not polite nor kind to assume like anybody wants to talk about their genitals, but like as... as an advocate and as an entertainer, I love sharing my like non-binary experiences, you know, of being a woman with a male body. I love it. I embrace it.
And, well, that's you.
Yeah. And I'm hoping that, you know, even if for people who are not exactly like me, that conceptually that kind of self-love and self-acceptance, you know, is translates, you know, because it's a universal kind of thing, regardless of your gender. But yeah, so anyway, what was I talking about?
I have to ask you a question. What did you study in school? You went to college, didn't you?
I did.
What did you study?
I was a double major in theater and English. A lot of Shakespeare.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
The reason why I ask is because I'm listening to you. You are one of the most well-spoken people I have ever met in my life.
Very articulate.
Very articulate. Yeah. And you're...
well, it's a very, very articulate of your thoughts and things like that, which is really good. That's a problem I have.
Me too.
Like, just like,
I can do an interpretive dance, but having it come out of my mouth, I don't know how to describe it. Let me mime it for you.
Yeah. That means so much to me. Thank you. That I feel a calling that, you know, if that's a talent of mine, I really credit. Well, I am liberally educated, so I should say it's aside from. The major, at least at my university, it was one of those like, doesn't matter. like choose whatever major you think is going to look good on a resume. But ultimately, the curriculum from Lawrence University, tag my alma mater, is, you know, in a liberal education, you learn how to think and you learn how to learn. So, you know, pick it. It's a little bit arbitrary. Whatever you fancy, whatever most intellectually stimulates you or you're passionate about, just make that your major. Because at the end of the day, the university curriculum is arranged in such a way that you will be an independent thinker. You'll have critical thinking skills. You'll have conceptual, you know, imagination skills. You'll be able to write and speak your mind efficiently and beautifully. You know, and it's like, whatever. You want to be a bartender who studied geology? Great. If you want to be an astrophysicist who studied theater, great. Like, it, at least that undergrad, my undergrad experience was very liberal, I guess, in that way. So I'm very thankful for that. But my mom was a kindergarten teacher. Mm-hmm. And I'm adopted. My parents are white.
It was so funny.
Really?
My mom owned a child care center for 25 years. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
I was going to mention about your parents, about how supportive they've been. I knew you were adopted, but I was going to bring that up again because I also think that they were American, of course, as opposed to they've obviously been very supportive and accepting of you. And I was just thinking, do you ever think, thank God I didn't actually grow up with Asian parents because I would have been disowned.
I did research on this because
educate me.
Yeah. Well, from what I can recall, it was a few months ago. and to the point, I would say it's not so much that they would be Asian parents, but that I would have been in South Korea as a culture. Cause so I'm adopted. My parents are white. I was born in 82. So do the math. I'm 20. And
that makes me 21.
Yeah. That makes me 19.
Barely. That's okay. You can get the beer for all of us.
I will. Yeah. Just don't
the
tell
ice
anyone.
Coolers.
Get your fake ID.
There was a lot of, and I'm Korean, there were a lot of Korean babies who were adopted in like I think it was like 78 through like 86. Like just a short period like after the Korean War. And there was I guess I didn't really know a lot about the politics about how it started, but for a very short while, international adoptions were really popular. And I was one of those babies. And then Korea shut them down or like significantly reduced them sometime, I think, in the 80s or early 90s. And it was a point of national pride, or at least it was my understanding of this. I am not a historian. and that the president at the time, I think, released some sort of statement of, we're sorry we couldn't take care of you. You thinking, oh, because from the Korean mindset, again, my understanding, I'm very much American, is that it's a matter of saving face in that culture. There's a certain kind of Yes. It's just different. It's not better or worse. It's different. And, you know, from my point of view, I'm like, well, thank goodness I can, of all Western nations, I ended up in, you know, America, because, you know, the person I ended up becoming, there was room for that in America, you know, and even growing up in the Midwest in a small town, I pushed at those edges so hard. I had I feel so blessed because my nuclear family, my parents and my sister have always really been supportive of me, even when they were confused. Like, I don't know what the fuck is up with this kid, but like, they're super independent and super confident. So we'll just see what happens. Like,
good for them.
Yeah. I was super confident because I knew I had love at home. That I wasn't going to lose anything for being myself, even though I didn't know how to tell them what that was. So I'm very, very lucky that even in that small town, Midwestern, homophobic, you know, like, transphobic, you know, youth where I was bullied for the first 18 years of my life, mercilessly, I still had love at home. And that really is what got me. And my mom's a kindergarten teacher. She taught me the value of the teaching moment as soon as I could talk. So it's like, even before I knew I was queer, I was fielding questions like, oh, do you ever want to find your real parents? Oh, so you're Oriental. So it's like, okay. And it's like, this is me at 7 years old. Actually, my real parents are the ones who raised me. Adopted people call their biological parents. Their biological parents are birth parents. Likewise, Oriental is a word we use to describe objects and concepts. Human beings are Asian.
Well, my big thing was always, what country are you from? I was like, I'm American, you shithead.
Yeah.
And they were just like, or
what's your nationality? Sometimes I just lie. I'd be like, well, I'm actually from the UK. Give me an excuse, yeah?
The accent.
I actually told, somebody asked me, just like, you know, oh, what's your ethnicity? And they were right about asking ethnicity, but I'm so tired of it at this point. And I said, well, I'm half Korean and I'm half Pomeranian.
And they're like, uh-huh, yeah.
They did. They were doesn't like, uh-huh. Click. And then I wait, what? And and because...
But it
I
makes
wanted to see people were listening. Yeah. And of course, people, but I was just getting tired of it. It's just like, yeah, let's just fuck with them. But the good thing is I am able to say, and I admit I have used this, is when somebody tries to talk to me, I make pretend I don't speak English. I'll just shake my head and I'll be like, no English.
I always answer my phone, mush, mushy, just because I don't want to talk to them.
Is there like a just silence on the other end for like a couple of seconds? Yep. And then it's like, if I got the right number here.
So there are advantages.
Oh, totally. Well, but my name, like your name is very classically Korean, right? Park?
Yes.
Yes.
And very, very Korean.
Mine is German, Indra. So people have no idea. So it's like that extra level. When I managed a theater, you know, I was a boy.
Well, no, but let me interrupt you.
Yeah, please do.
I've had people say to me, why are you trying to anglicize your name? And I was like, that is one of the top three Korean names.
Yeah, that's like the Smith of Korea.
Kim, Lee, and...
Cho.
No, not Cho.
Oh, not
Kim,
Cho.
Lee, and Park.
I'm Park. Kim, yeah. Kim,
they
Lee
say
Park.
If you are on a mountain and you throw a rock into Korea, you're going to land on one of the three.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's how common. And I come from my whole family. They're Kim, Lees, and Parks, by the way. So I just think that's pretty hilarious. But I've had people say that to me. It's like, why are you? Because there are people, I've met people who are actually from Great Britain and their last name is Park or Parks. Mm. And so I guess I kind of understand why people would think that, but it's also a bit ignorant.
Yeah.
Well, to say, you're just trying to anglicize your name. That's insulting and ignorant.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, and what makes you think you have any authority to comment on such a thing in the first place? I was at this casting session one time and an Asian casting director, she said something like, oh, so do you speak Korean? And I said, I'm like, oh, no, I'm adopted. I grew up in Wisconsin. And she's like, you know, I have a friend who doesn't speak Korean either, who's adopted. Oh, self-loathing much? And I'm like, excuse me, bitch. You don't know me. You don't know my life. It's like talk to me about self-loathing. I dare you.
Was she saying that you were self-loathing because you didn't speak?
It was a passive-aggressive illusion.
Because you didn't speak Korean? Is that
because I'm Korean and I don't speak Korean.
So her assumption was like you were upset about that, the fact that you didn't speak? Is that what
you, I was not upset. She, I,
but what
I believe,
she thought.
I believe she was making a passive aggressive jab at me by sharing in a contextually unrelated story about her friend who's also adopted in Korean who refuses to learn Korean. And I found
I
that
refuse,
it's,
okay,
yeah,
refuse,
it's a, yeah, it's a weird kind of reverse xenophobia almost, or like a point of pride, but it's also a Korean thing as I'm learning, is that the sense of national pride for, you know, the Korean culture is also just, it's baked in. And in my research, I figured out I was doubly lucky, not just as a queer person to grow up in America, but the fact that I am assigned male at birth, that in South Korea, the hereditary patriarchy is through bloodlines of the male relative. So even domestic Korean adoptions, which are also problematic because of single mothers and giving up babies and everything, is also very taboo and unsafe. Like a woman's entire future could be ruined if it was on record somewhere that she had a baby out of wedlock. And so the thing is, even domestic adopters' parents prefer to adopt female babies because they don't want to enter in the possibility of legal trouble having an adopted male baby and his possible, you know, patriarchy,
bloodline
stuff. And again, this was internet research. So do not...
Grain of salt.
Yes, grain of salt. but the thing is, it's, I mean, I'm grateful regardless, but I'm thinking, oh gosh, so even if I had stayed in Korea, there could have been a very real possibility that I would have been an orphan for a really long time if not
Because
forever.
No one would have adopted you.
Because it was too risky. It's, yeah. You know, and I mean, there's... I hate to comment on cultures within which I have not personally lived, you know? So I think it's important for me to just check in right now and let everyone know I'm not at all shading Korea. I'm just very happy from my own personal experience having growing up a Korean American. Mm.
I wish I could throw more information and light on the Korean culture, but I'm pathetic because I can't. Because I would love to be. Well, actually, I know. No, because...
In the home country.
Yeah, in the home country. No, because I was born and raised on the East Coast. And my mother, thank God, was very Americanized, as was my father, I know, before he passed away. And my grandmother was very, very open. So I didn't get a lot of the old country cultures embedded into my system. So, but I also feel a bit now like, I don't really know anything about the mother country.
It's a hard thing for immigrant families, right? Because there's the pressure to assimilate and all of the opportunities that you can have. But then, you know, the loss of culture, because if you're not in it all the time, it's like I mean, I don't know, because I'm not personally an immigrant. I was naturalized as an infant, so I didn't know any better. But but I do know, like having studied French for 7 years, it's like when I was actually studying it, I was, you know, achieving, you know, conversational fluency. And then I stopped studying it. I don't remember.
I was the same way. Yeah. I can't remember. But Korean was my second language growing up. Up until I was about 10 years old. Oh yeah, they spoke it. Now I just lost it. And I don't know when, where, how it disappeared. I can still understand it if people talk to me. I know everything without having to translate it in my head, but I cannot speak back.
Well, what about when, I assume if you just started studying again, would it all just kind of come flooding back? Because it's in there. It's in there.
I think it would because I haven't been to Korea many times, but the few times I have, the first two times I went as an infant, I do remember. And also I was told I didn't speak one word of English. They wanted me to speak English and I just spoke Korean the entire time. Mm-hmm. I think I was embarrassed. And then I went there right before I went to drama school. And that was the last time I was there. And I was there for my brother's wedding. So it was, he married a lovely Korean woman. They now live on the East Coast. But I was there for a good month. And it did. It was coming back. And sometimes I will watch K-drama because first of all, it's pretty good. and second of all, I'm listening. I'm looking at the subtitles. And I know when it's finally getting in there, when I don't have to look at the subtitles anymore. I can just understand what they're saying. And so I will, but I just have trouble speaking back. Yeah. I can't form the words in my mouth. My tongue and my mouth don't know what to do.
Do you listen to K-pop? Is that, am I correct in K-pop? Is it K-pop?
I don't listen to K-pop.
No.
K-pop is music. K-drama is telly.
Yes. No, I was just saying K-pop. Oh. Do you listen to K-pop?
Yeah. I was like, new question.
I was just kind of like, you know, is it called K-pop? I was just wanting to know.
It is K-pop. And apparently there's this new band
I drove past them
BTS?
The other day.
BTS?
I'm not too sure, but there was a massive bus with their faces. There's like four or five of them or something like that on the side of the bus. And I was driving past and I was like, what's going on here? Because there was just lines of people everywhere. And I think they were coming out of their hotel or something like that.
What? So they're a big deal?
Yeah.
Like the Beatles?
Yeah.
Oh, come
massive.
On. Massive. That big?
Potential.
Really?
Potential.
I mean, good for them, but I just... never heard of them before, but no, I didn't listen to K-pop. That was,
going off on that little tangent right there.
Sometimes I think, oh wow, if I had stayed in Korea, I could have been one of those Disney prodigy Cinderella stars and I'm a K-pop kid.
There's still time. Yeah. There's still time.
Still time. I do think, I read something where it's like South Korea is like the only country in the world whose cosmetics sales to men outperform their cosmetic sales to women.
Really?
I did love that. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. What's why do you think that's the case?
Well, I guess in that culture, there's the idea of beauty and self-care isn't considered an exclusively feminine routine that, you know, it's successful for everyone to do it. And so it's kind of a combination of because there's a market for it and an industry that provides for it, versus with to men, but then the cosmetics made and marketed to women are also Western and international, so that those kind of profits are a little more split. So it allows the comparison to look.
Isn't during the Victorian times like men wore makeup all the time as well?
I think it was Victorian where you're not supposed to wear makeup. Oh. I think that's when they were like pinching their cheeks and stuff because if they wore blush, they were porous.
Isn't there a period where like men had like white makeup all over their face?
The Renaissance.
And then, was that the Renaissance?
The Reformation, I think.
The Reformation.
Wearing high heels as well, I think. Was it that period as well?
That was the Versailles era.
Baroque.
I'd love to... I'm guessing. We're just guessing.
I know words. Gothic, Baroque.
But I was coaching a Korean American student, and but he's slightly more knowledgeable about Koreans than I am, and he actually said that the men are starting to wear BB cream, and I said, oh, I said, yeah. I said, my mom just sent me a little thing of BB cream. And I said, but apparently, I don't know, you just wear it all over your face.
What's BB cream?
Beauty balm.
A tinted.
Yeah, it's like a tinted moisturizer, sometimes with sunscreen. I get the one with sunscreen because I'm all
smart.
About efficiency.
Plus, we're in LA. Yeah.
Sunscreen is very important to Asians, by the way, or protecting yourself from the sun.
That's why we look young forever.
Yeah. Yeah. You see the hooded people with the glasses and the hats?
Yes, they're
Korean. The visors.
I need to wear sunscreen.
Right,
I've like my background is English and Irish. I'm as white as they come. I need my sunscreen.
Well, you need everybody because you need to protect against UV rays. And,
and the world is ending.
And the world.
That is true.
That's your point. But he was saying
depending
that
on who you ask, 6, 12, 20 years.
And I was just like, oh, really? And apparently it's a big thing in Korea.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think BB cream should be a big bang everywhere.
Yeah, but I don't wear BB cream. I don't wear anything on my face except moisturizer and sunscreen. And
humble brag.
My point, I wasn't trying to brag, but he was actually shocked. My point was he was shocked because in his eyes, he still views me as a Korean woman because I don't think he was born here. I think he was born there. So this is why I say he's still embedded deeply into the Korean culture. Mm. And how could I not be wearing BB cream like every other Korean woman? Yeah. I was affronted by that. I admit.
Yeah.
It's like, because I'm very proud to be American and I was born and raised here. So, I mean, this country has its strengths and its weaknesses like every
country. Yeah.
But I should sing a song on Independence Day with the flag. Anyway, I digress. Anyway,
you said before you do stand up.
I do.
Yeah. How long have you been doing stand up for?
This year.
Oh, really?
Like, just got into it. Like 6 months.
Yesterday.
That seems like the most terrifying thing in the world for me. We were talking about this before. Like, just
it is
takes
terrifying
guts to do stand up, in my opinion.
I think
I
it
agree.
Does, too.
Just, I agree.
No.
I agree.
So, you're bearing your soul.
How do you do that? You obviously, do you talk about being Asian and transgender? Okay, mm-hmm. See, I'm trying to learn the vernacular here because I don't ever want to say anything that could be insulting, not knowing.
Yeah, and I say this to allies all the time. It's like, it's not about being perfect. It's about letting us know how much you care.
Oh, we do.
Because that's really all it is, right? I don't want to reveal publicly people's names. Okay, I know this person. And when we're out in public together, sometimes they'll be all like, yeah, well, you know, because you're transgender. I'm like, no.
That's a very sexy way
of saying
that.
That's a very, right. That was my poor acting. It's like, no, it's not a dirty word. No, that's the good word. That's the word we want to promote. Transgender. It's like transsexual is problematic because it's very much about, it reduces to genitals and like assignments. But there are people, especially.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah, let me tell you real quick. There are people of a certain generation and one, for instance, a very public advocate and adult performer, Buck Angel, mm-hmm. whom I follow, he very much identifies as transsexual, and that's his identity, and he's proud of that. And I love that. For me, it's a problematic word, but again, it's perspective, right? He's of a different generation. So for him, it feels powerful. It feels empowering. It feels like advocacy. And
like he's taken that word?
Yeah. And the way he talks about it and the way he talks about himself and his experiences, I get it. No shade. Like I follow him. However, I don't talk about that way about me. And I think that's okay. But the perspective that I'm hoping people, it's not about right or wrong, but there is a certain kind of sensitivity around, okay, well, why and how is it right for this person? And why and how might it be problematic outside of the context of that particular person being public about it? Etc. And I've met, you know, older trans people who are in a different generation than me who have disclosed to me, it's like, you know, I had all the medical stuff done, I medically transitioned, but like your generation is so lucky. I think that if I were, you know, 30 years younger, I think I would have been like you, that I would have just lived the way I lived and, you know, because I didn't hate my body, but I thought I needed to change it in order to be who I was. And then there is, you know, those strongly dysphoric people where it does feel like you're just born in the wrong body. Like you look in the mirror and you know who you are and that's not you, you know?
Do you call it dysphoria? Like gender dysphoria?
Dysphoria.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I have a bit about that because I don't have...
Go ahead.
I don't have gender
dysphoria.
Oh, I can. Okay. Yeah.
Let's do it.
All right. Okay. So imagine I'm on a stage, right? I'm like, so I talk about, you know, it's always obvious since I was trans, but, I didn't realize I was trans until I was grown because I don't experience a lot of gender dysphoria. I experience gender euphoria. Want an example? I'll give you an example. So I love it when especially cisgender women compliment me on my arms. They'd be like, girl, you are so toned. What's your secret? Do you do Pilates? I'm like, no, sweetie, it's my balls. They do all the heavy lifting.
There you go.
Testosterone, baby. Testosterone.
Yep. Well done.
I'm proud of it.
Where can somebody, just to digress a little bit or change the step? Somebody please get me a cup of coffee or a Red Bull.
Let's get a 5 Red Bull stat.
I used to be very eloquent when I spoke, but obviously that has just gone.
It's Red Bull dependent.
It's actually very addictive and I always hated the taste, but it did give me wings.
Oh my God. Plug for Red Bull right there. We're going to get a case sent to your place.
Please send it. It's 4-8. Just kidding.
It's one of those like, thanks, but no thanks.
Where can people catch your next show?
I am at, I'm doing a Manic Monday show at Flappers in Burbank on July 29th.
Nice.
Please come on down. Follow me on Insta. I post everything on Insta and Facebook. So just quick, if you want to follow me, please do. I'm at Mix Nikki E. I use the non-binary honorific mix. And I like just sort of the wordplay. It's a mix of things. So it's MXNICKYE, Mix Nikki E. And that's the same for all of my social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc. Follow me. Come see me. Love to see you at the show. Introduce yourself.
Sounds Let's good. See. Do you have a like a YouTube channel or anything like that? Or
you should.
I should.
Yeah.
I should.
Totally.
I have I do have an idea for that I'm fleshing out right now.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to give too much away.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like
stealing it.
Yeah, and I want to make sure like someone else hasn't already done it but whatever. It's an idea. So
just you know, as I say, stand on the shoulder of giants. Just take an idea of what somebody's done and make it better.
I don't begrudge anyone who does that.
That's how we advance as a society.
Yeah.
You just take, oh, that was a really good idea. You did that. So I'm going to flip it and do something here and do something there and then make it my own thing. And then it becomes its whole own beast.
And we're actually in a zeitgeist where that's really being championed right now.
Yeah.
All the remakes and nostalgia.
Mm. Yeah.
It's not like, oh, how can I do this differently? But it's like,
but the same.
The same. It's like, how can you make me feel like it's different while showing me the same? It's a weird, nostalgia is a weird thing.
It's like pop music.
Yeah.
They say like you listen to it and you like not immediately, but a lot of people immediately like it because they go, "Why? It sounds like a song that they've liked before because they use the same formula and the same makeup for most, I mean, a particular kind of pop music.
Yeah.
And so that's why a lot of people really like the pop music and the songs is because they sound like previous ones. They don't necessarily sound like it, but the makeup of it.
They've been engineered.
There's science to it.
That's what I mean. Subconsciously, they might not even know why.
Yeah.
It's like a certain progression of intervals or something. I mean, like, I'm actually not musical at all. I just date a lot of musicians.
Are you single now?
No, I am in a polyamorous relationship with my core partner who's my poly version of the one that, you know, monogamous people usually, not usually. I don't mean to throw shade. I'm not like poly's better than mono. It's whatever's right for you.
Yeah.
But I am poly. And
explain to the to listeners if they don't know what poly is.
Oh, yeah. So poly is a shorthand for polyamorous or polyamory, which means many loves. And it's a relationship style that says, you know, you can love and commit and be in meaningful relationships with more than one person at the same time. I also identify as an ethical slut.
What is that?
Based on the book, please check it out. It's the closest thing to a Bible I ever read.
Is it called Ethical Slut?
It's called The Ethical Slut.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's a sex positive book that really talks about sort of reframing the notion of scripted cishet normative binary monogamy and gender roles and thinking about sex in a very fundamental way, that sex and sexuality should be free of shame and judgment, that sex is healthy and natural and that pleasure's good for you. And to be ethical, though.
We're built for it.
Yeah. It's not enough just to run around wantonly. If you have very high risk tolerance, that's your own freedom. But you owe it, I think, to communicate that to other people and honor their boundaries. Because really, sex positivity to me is really all comes down to consent and
communication.
Consent, care, communication. And so the ethical part of sluttery is, you know, just a lot of
sluttery.
Sluttery.
That's such a good word.
I practice ethical sluttery. And, you know, there's lots of like, you know, so people like something from the book that I love, they're all like, they accuse us of being easy. We wonder, is there some virtue in being difficult?
I can see that. Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's like, oh, so sluts are just wanton people who don't care. It's like, no, it's the opposite. We care more and we do more work because we have more points of contact. And, you know, if we want all of those relationships to be healthy, I mean, just think how much work goes into one partnership, one marriage, right?
Yeah.
Those of us who at least do poly and ethical sluttery my way, there are lots of different ranges and combinations. It's very customized for each individual group of people that are just, you know, whatever's right for them. For me, I like to explain my experience in relationships as well. It's like all the work that you do in one marriage and or one best friendship, you do many times. And for me, the work is difficult. It's challenging. Mm. But the rewards make it so worth it.
Anything that's difficult, if the reward is worth it, you do it. It's just like as actors, we're all actors here. And we know the road is sometimes you get so despondent.
Difficult. Yeah.
I mean, that's the only word I can think of is even more than depressed, you're despondent.
Yeah.
But when you are rewarded, the reward, getting a job, booking a job, even if it's just for one day. I mean, you are on a high that as if the Lord himself just came down and plucked you up and just took him with you up into the heavens.
Yeah, and all that hard work was worth it, that kind of thing.
All that hard work was worth it, even if it's just for 8 hours.
That's how you know it's for you, right?
Yeah.
It's like other people for whom it's not right can easily and understandably judge that as insanity. Like, why do you do that to yourself? What, you have no stability. You don't have. It's like, well, I get your point of view and I appreciate your point of view. For me though, this is my default. This is my calling. This is what feeds me. This is ultimately what makes me happy, even though what makes me happy is a roller coaster ride of, WTF am I doing my life? You know, I remind people who, you know, who don't understand, who are not in our industry. I'm like, got to remember, we have job opportunities based in the same discrimination that is illegal in other industries.
Yes, that's very true.
It's an ironic twist. It's like, our challenge as artists is to be as open and vulnerable and beautiful as an artist can be while still being the hardest, baddest ass bitches who can survive anything.
That's very true. Like, it really is. The way they decide who gets a particular role, if you found out, like, if you genuinely found out why they picked you or why they didn't pick you or anything like that, it is very discriminatory. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's like,
it could be down to he's too tall.
Yeah. Too tall.
You know? I don't like his nose. One eye is bigger than the other. Yeah. I mean, it's anything.
I've heard
and
somebody
with people of color. Like, we've already got an Asian one.
It's
like,
what?
Yeah.
Like with people of color, sometimes we already have an Asian one. Or, oh, we can't have a black lead and an Asian lead. We need a white person and a lead. Right?
But it's balanced out so that it's like, oh, now we, it's not just, oh, we already have our black actor or Asian actor or Latino actor. It's now we already have our white actor.
Mm-hmm.
And because I will say, because I'm friends with a lot of people like Dan, you know, Caucasian, male, good looking, you know, in the early to late 30s range.
That's right.
Actually, most of them do have an accent. No. But you guys, I've never heard, because I coach so much, that you guys are struggling even to get auditions. Because the people I do coach, Nikki, they have been more women now, yay, and diverse women.
Mm-hmm.
This is who my clients are, my students.
Your black book.
These are my students.
Yes.
And people like Dan are really struggling.
Rare at the moment. Because I do self-taping and coaching as well. And
you see it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Very rarely do I see a, you know, straight white man.
Or even a white female.
Yeah. And the only white females that come in are young, like playing like teenagers or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I have a 16-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah.
I take no pleasure in anybody's suffering.
No, I don't
but
either.
But I do think, I forget which civil rights person said this, but that famous quote where it's, when you're accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression. Because I've heard from some of, you know, my white friends, it's like, oh gosh, it's so hard. It's like, it's always been hard. You've just had it a little bit easier for a while. It's always been.
Say that
makes sense.
Say that again.
Sons. Sense.
Yes.
Sons. That makes sense.
It makes sense, mate.
Yeah.
Sorry.
G'day.
Yeah.
What's that quote again? Because I'm just
the civil rights one?
Yeah.
Well, we can Google it because then we'll know who said it and we can properly credit them.
Okay.
But yeah, to someone who's accustomed to privilege, equality feels like oppression.
Mm. Fascinating. But I will say, yes, I'm not about anybody's suffering. As someone who's been on the producing side, I always think to myself, just go for the best actor for the job, the best actor slash actress for the part. Mm-hmm. That is how I've always kind of looked at it. Even when I was suffering and roles weren't out there for me.
Yeah. So. Well, it's like that, it's that tension, right? Between art and product. Because we're in an industry that tells stories that makes art, but we have to sell it.
Make money.
So it's and thankfully the audiences, the customers are demanding multiple points of view, more diverse points of view. And it's not, I argue, and this is me, a queer person of color, it's not a virtue signaling thing. It's not just a diversity for like Buddha's sake, okay? It is telling affective, genuine stories that touch people's hearts require the nuances of humanity. And you get those nuances by including more diverse points of view.
Yeah.
It's good storytelling. It's good art. I mean, you look in art history, and actually I shouldn't even go in there because I'm not an expert. I should say what I admire when I read about art history is that so many landmark shifts in the different eras, and stages of what we now see as historical were based so much in economic situations of the time and trade and colonialism. But just the mixing of cultures, the exposure to new cultures, the influence of cultures, the copying of cultures, the appropriation of cultures, so whether it be good or bad or politically motivated or just for art's curiosity for its own sake, we have a recorded rich history of diversity making things better and more interesting. So I'm very optimistic. I've never been more optimistic than I am right now in this day and age for people like us in the industry. I will say what's challenging though is because of all this diversity in voices, it's not enough just to be an actor anymore. This is why I'm doing stand-up, I'm writing, I'm learning, I'm so daunted.
I was just going to ask if you're running anything or creating your own, film, TV or anything of that nature.
I've got a television idea. This is the thing. I have all the notes, but I don't know how to write a screenplay yet. So I just took a sketch class at UCB. I was going to just take all improv because I'm an actor. But then I thought, it's not that, I already know that. It's like, acting feels like home to me. I really need to be challenging myself to things that I know I'm bad at. Mm-hmm. The things that I know
go outside the box. I hear very few people in this town say that. Challenge yourself at something you're bad at.
You have to these days. When a sixth grader in Ohio can become a YouTube star with no talent,
is that the kid
of charisma.
Is that the kid that plays like,
I am not referencing anyone specific. Oh, okay. I'm pulling it out of my ass. But you know what I mean though? Like with a total amateur with no stakes or interest in the entertainment industry other than their own personal amusement or expression of creativity can, become popular or resonate with people. Mm. The content, lower capital C content, is like the thing, at least right now in this, streaming, digital, like super media globalization age. And I, as an artist, kind of both am thankful for it because it's challenging, but resent it because it's like, I devoted 15 of my years to this, years of my life to this thing.
Yeah,
and you're asking me to do all these other things now.
Yeah.
But then as a professional, I'm like, we're all entrepreneurs, actually. I mean, we who are independent artists, we're entrepreneurs. It's like, all right, well, I have to be a good business person.
Yeah.
I look at the market.
Well, this is show business.
Show business,
You have to be as well. Like, as I say, evolution happened because it wasn't the survival of the fittest. It was survival of the most adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you just have to adapt. Yeah. Otherwise, you're going to, disappear.
So back to the writing. Get Final Draft. It does all the work for you.
And just write.
And just write. And here's the thing, because I wrote something, and now I was an English major like you, and I was also a book editor at one point for a very popular, famous book series. But I will say that I've never written a screenplay, different format completely.
Yeah.
And my screenwriter friend said to me, you know what, even if you just have one word, just jot it down. Or even if you know the middle and just a scene, do that part and it will all come together eventually. Mm-hmm. Just do like with Dan and I, when we started the podcast, 5 minutes a day, just a little bit, let's not, but I will tell you that in 2 days, I wrote 90 pages. Because once I started, and then I started doing it, there were times when I had a mental block and I said, well, I already know the ending of the movie, so let's go that way.
Just right
and then
now, yeah.
And then I went backwards. And so just start.
Reverse engineer it.
like comics do. We were talking about this earlier, how comics sometimes, they find the punchline first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they reverse engineer it.
In my notes, I have two sections. Punchlines without setups and setups without punchlines. And because like sometimes you think of it and you're like, I want to do something with that. I've got like a phone full of audio notes because I'm getting ahead of my own resistances. That's what was my whole thing. My New Year's resolution is no more resistance. And if you feel resistance, just find a different way. Like, because I figure I'm a martial artist. It's just my mode of thinking is, like include. Because the more you try to resist or fight something, you're still defining whatever it is by that struggle. And I'm like, okay, if I am having a hard time carrying a notebook around or writing shit down, well, maybe that's not my way for taking notes.
Yeah.
So I'm like, so if I audio record it, that's my way of taking notes. I'm like, well, then of course I've got to put it into my document at some point. I'm like, but that's my first round of editing. Like, let's use that to our advantage. So I'm trying to get ahead of my own kind of cognitive biases and areas of resistance. Like, I'm a huge perfectionist, and that's terrible for an artist because there's no such thing. And it's like, I psych myself out into this like echo chamber of like downward spiral of just not doing it because I'm too concerned with like the final product. I'm like, honey, it's never going to be that way. So again, pieces, and the fun is in the editing. And I used to hate editing. I still resist it. I have that relationship with it. But every time I do it, it feels like magic. Like, and if anything, sometimes it's an artistic ego trip, right? Where I'm like, wow, okay, I can put this in because I set this up. I didn't do it on purpose, but I see an opportunity now, right? And it's just, I'm just reformulating my relationship with the types, the modalities of how I create. And I'm just trying to just get rid of like any kind of intimidation and just go for it.
Well, it's like what you said earlier. You're just throwing away the script.
Yeah.
For your life. And just saying, wee.
Oh gosh, I'm putting a lot of that one in. I'm so excited about it, but I don't want to like...
Don't give it away. Don't give it away.
It's one of those things. It'll have its time when it's ready to be public. But the thing is though, right? Because that was also something I struggled with is oh, well, just write. It's like, well, write what I know. I mean, you know what? Now, I have to love it. Because if I don't love it, the resistance is going to win. I have to love it.
Yeah. Well, that's anything you do, isn't it? Well, some people can not like something and still do it. I am not of that nature.
Yeah.
As Dan knows very well, I say I am inherently lazy. But when I really love to do something, I will give you 1,000% and more. Mm-hmm. And I become a workaholic.
Yeah.
So my mom is so like, she really knew I loved acting because I was just working all the time in the producing. I mean, working on the craft, not...
Yeah.
Where is your four houses in Malibu?
Exactly. But it was that. And then, and so now I have the kind of, I'm a walking oxymoron of being lazy and yet a workaholic. So.
Yeah, there you go.
It's one of those like stereotypes of the artist, but you know, I don't necessarily think that's untrue. I mean, that's my experience too. There's, you know, because like my day job is with like corporate stuff, and thankfully I work for a friend who's, you know, got his own business. So still, like even in my like conventional job, I'm unconventional in that I'm a contractor. But some of our clients, you know, are very like hierarchical and old school and corporate. I'm just like, wow. To me,
that is not security. That is not making the world a better place. To me, that is soul killing. But I have friends who love it and they feel safe. They feel like they can put their kids through school. They can buy a home that, you know, and that they, and if, especially when they believe and have stock in like the company that they're working for, that that company is actually participating in the world in a way that they believe is healthy and beautiful and progressive. So it's like, I can't shade them for that choice. That's what's right for them. But for me, I don't care how much I love your company. I just, being in the corporate culture itself is not for me. Of course, you know, in entertainment, there's a whole like, once you get to the executive, it's all that too.
Yeah.
But it's still, it's I don't know, our business is just sort of its own thing.
Is it because we like not having a structured way of life? What do you think? We don't have to get up at 9 o'clock for a 9 o'clock job, and then
no, you have to get up at like you got 5 o'clock.
No, but even then, when you're on set, it changes.
It changes all the time.
5 a.m. one day, it could be 2 p.m. the next day, and it's just it's always exciting and new, and I like that. What am I looking for? What word am I looking for? Help me out here, people.
Dynamism.
Yes.
Yes, dynamism.
I'm looking for that dynamism. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's diversity in your work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, I love the fact that things change all the time and you get to play different characters all the time. And that comes with auditions and stuff like that as well. It's like you get to, you know, be this character and then you get to be this character and all that sort of stuff. And it could be something just a part of our personality and why we gravitate towards this particular business. But I mean, of course, there are people who just want to be stars and there are other people who love acting and love creating and love doing this. And so...
And to each their own.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's probably the best attitude to have with life. It's like each to their own, you know, let...
Yeah.
You know, it's like as long as they're not hurting anyone else.
Yeah, it's like I love the craft of being an actor. This is why I went to drama school, mm-hmm. why I spent the money, and it was a lot of money to go to drama school to displace myself in another country as well. And it is, even though it was England, it is a cultural difference, trust me. Just because they speak the same language doesn't mean they're anything like
and
us.
Darling, we know it's not the same language.
It's the Queen's.
Queen's English. So when I was younger, I used to judge the people. I did, I admit that, who just didn't care about the craft and just wanted to be a star. Now I couldn't give two shits. And it's just everybody's on their own path.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, some people I know who just wanted to be a movie star, and they do an awful lot of work to help the community.
Yeah.
And this is something that I've always wanted to do, is have a platform to launch off so I can get involved and have a louder, more important voice. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm totally on that same wavelength. You know, someone recently asked me, it's like, so what do you think about fame? And I'm like, well, for me personally, I would love to be famous, but not for my own ego, for the access to opportunities.
Yeah, exactly.
It
comes with it.
Yeah.
It's like,
you know. And I'm like, I'm willing. I'm, in fact, like, it's one of those funny self-fulfilling prophecy things. It's like ever since I was little. And it sounds like a silly game, but I admit it to you freely. I hope there are paparazzi filming me. I hope people are trying to get candid images. Like, so, because I'm like, if I can get ahead of it, like mentally, like cognitively, if I can expect it someday, if and when it happens, I won't resent the shitty side of success. I could be like, you know what? I prepared to step into the beautiful parts of success. But, you know, nothing's 100% beautiful. Like, everything's a mixed bag. So it's like, I want to, yeah, exactly. And it's just, and maybe it's my martial arts training or
what kind
because
of martial arts did you do? Do you do?
Korean martial arts.
Taekwondo?
One of the many branching styles. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I started in Hwarangdo and I got a black belt when I was like 16 in their hard style subset, Taesudo. And I studied Subakdo in Hollywood, which is similar to Tangsudo. And now I'm studying Taekwondo and Hapkido.
Wow. My goodness.
Kill a motherfucker.
I'll have you walk around with me all the time. As my bodyguard.
I joke all the time. It's like my mom said, she put me in martial arts when I was a kid. And she's like, I just think it'd be good for you to get in touch with your Korean heritage. And I still think, she's like, I don't want you to get hate crimed. So
that, do you think that was her motivation?
Yeah.
Okay. Good mom though.
I mean, both probably. I mean, she was, you know, my parents were so lost. And we talk about this to this day now that I'm an adult and have like, and actually I'm processing as an adult that, you know, I was traumatized as a kid and not from like, thankfully not like one like life-threatening, you know, like instance or one, like one thing. It was 18 consecutive years of harassment that at the time I was told was bullying, that kids, this is just what adolescence is. Kids are mean. You have to just ignore it. Or, you know, within the frame of the 21st century, we call that bullying.
Yeah.
We call that harassment. We call that assault, the things that kids did to me. But it was a different era. There were definitely queer people in my community, but none of them were out. They couldn't. They were all afraid of their job, for their jobs, for their safety. And you know, people like, oh, come on, like you're right next door to Madison. It couldn't have been that bad. I'm like, it's because we were next to Madison that it's only as bad as I remember. You know, and it's, I mean, this was the 90s. This was Matthew Shepard time. You know, this was Brandon Tina time. You know, like Boys Don't Cry came out. I saw it with some friends and like they were straight allies and they were so upset. And I'm like, yeah, and they're like, I grew up with people like this. I know people like this. And it's like, and until they knew me or, you know, other queer people growing up, you know, they're just like, I just totally took for granted that the people that I knew as my neighbors, you know, could be like this. And so thankfully, you know, like in movies and stories, that's why I think that what we do is so important. Like, yes, yeah, it's a business. Yes, we're, you know, peddling flesh and everything. But also it's like those bits of stories that get out there that help expose, you know, people with, you know, who live in, we all live in our own bubbles. So I don't mean to say like only people where I grew up are in a bubble. We're in a fucking bubble in California. But,
right? Different bubble.
That's why I'm here. But, you know, it just, we can sort of penetrate those bubbles and open hearts and minds. And yeah, that's, I think, why comedies come really naturally to me too. Because like I would disarm, you know, my, harassers, bullies, or whatever, with humor. And I developed, you know, humor as a defense for depression. And so, like, ever since I moved here, they're like, you know, they, lots of people. Like, mm-hmm. It's like, oh, so you do stand up, right? I'm like, no, I'm an actor. And they're like, oh, well, you should do stand up. I mean, no, my thing. 15 years later, I'm like, all right, so I'm doing stand-up. Finally. Oh my God. Okay, well, where's your shows? I need to see you. And then like people come and I'm like, oh, I'm surprised. I didn't know I had so many friends. Like, oh, they come. They like, they support me. I feel so blessed. And but you know, it's a lot of the work that I've been doing. Cause I was a lone wolf and very cynical growing. And actually this is a recent sort of thing in the last few years where I was realizing, you know, my cynicism was a distancing effect. And seeing the worst in people came from a self-defense point of view growing up. But, you know, it's like, I'm in a different place now. I'm an adult. I have agency. I have rights, you know, it's like, so that same, I don't need to use that in the same way. It's no longer helping me. It's hurting me. It's distancing me from connection, and reinforcing this negative idea that all the of misanthropy, like everyone's out to get me and everybody's horrible and you always got to expect a con around every corner, which to be fair, you don't want to be naive. But like these days, what kind of helped turn the corner into comedy is that for me, it's therapeutic and not in the way that God, sounds so woo. What I mean by that is I'm motivated to do comedy because, well, one, I'm falling in love with it. And two, it's healing for me in that in addressing my cynicism, because I own it's a part of me. I'm never going to get rid of it. It's just, it's 30 years and that's just what it is. But I'm like, instead of trying to get rid of it and resenting it and shaming myself for it, why don't I use it as a diagnostic tool? Let me see if my first gut knee-jerk reaction is to always look for the worst in people, why don't I look for how people are suffering and use that to encourage my compassion, which I'm working on a lot as well. And furthermore, when, I mean, all comedy is based in suffering, right? Like that's the identifying part of a joke that makes us laugh at it and feel connected. It's not, oh, because everybody's life is perfect, is because we all know what it's like to suffer, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a very...
Even in film and TV, we watch it, or plays, theater, is we always root for the underdog. Because we feel that in them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sorry.
And like in the catharsis of like the expressing of those emotions when we're moved and we cry or we laugh, you know, it's nothing quite, you know, transports us through time and space in sometimes a very literal way, in physiological way, than, you know, theater, joke, a great story. And yeah, so for me, I guess it's, that's why I'm so passionate about comedy right now is I love it. And it's also very healing for me.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So come see me, everyone.
Yeah, totally. Let everybody know once again.
Yeah. So my next show is at Flappers in Burbank on the 29th of July, which is a Monday. Come see me then. And you know, as I add more shows, because I kind of just pop up, please follow me, social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. I'm at Mix Nikki E, MXNICKYE. I hope to see you there.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, yeah. Nikki. You were a delight. You are a delight.
Thank you so absolutely. Much for inviting me.
Thank you for coming on the show. It's been fantastic. And it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Feeling is mutual.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers.